in these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there, I'll lock my heart to any other caress, I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
And welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we do have a literary agent, Julie Bearer, from New York, and novelist Michael Tolkien. First up is Julie Bearer. She started her own agency, Bearer Literary Agency, in 2005 after working for 6 years at the New York literary agency Sanford J. Greenberger Associates. She represents a wide range of fiction writers, we like to hear that always, and who publish across the literary spectrum from short story collections to young adult novels, and she also represents a variety of nonfiction clients whose specialties include biography, memoir, narrative nonfiction, history, and popular culture. Before becoming an agent, Julie worked at the very famous Shakespeare and Company booksellers in New York City. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
You know, there's hardly an agent I know that represents short story collections. Talk about this.
I know. They're a tough business these days. They really are. I think that short story collections need some kind of, like, PR campaign. They need a makeover because, you know, they're wonderful. I love them so much. But it's hard to find people who buy them. People, for some reason or another, people buy novels. They don't buy short story collections in the same numbers. So they can be incredibly difficult to place with publishers.
Yeah. I would imagine it helps if those short stories have been published in prominent publications like The New Yorker and, you know, Zoetrope and all of those publications. What about the lesser-known journals, though? Does that
Think that helps. I think that there are so many wonderful literary journals out there, and I think a lot of them have been around for a long time and have really built up incredible reputations. And publishers and editors look at them, I know, for writers as agents do, and also take note of a writer who's been published in those as sort of, you know, that they've maybe established a little bit of an audience, a little bit of a fan base. They've established some connections with the editors of those journals. So that definitely makes a difference, and I do encourage a lot of the writers that I meet who are starting out to get some practice by sending out stories to journals, to magazines, to websites, to get both those credentials built up and to get the experience.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about just agenting and how it is these days, because we, you know, on this side of the desk, we hear horrid things having to do with fiction and pretty okay stuff regarding, say, self-help or business or technology.
It can be, it's, I think, both an incredibly exciting business right now and also an incredibly difficult one. And I was very naive when I got into it, when I first started about 7 years ago. I sort of, because I was a huge fiction reader my whole life, and I you know, prized short story collections and first novels above all else, I sort of naively thought that was what, you know, sells. That's what everybody
mm-hmm.
read.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. And it has become, you know, a difficult climate for fiction. As I, you know, the longer I've been in the business, the more I've seen how harder and harder it is to break out debut writers, to keep the momentum of a literary writer's career going. I think it's a matter of maybe people taking less chances on writers that they haven't heard of, you know, not wanting, you know, people don't buy a lot of hardcover fiction, and they want to, you know, they don't want to take the risk. They want to buy the same writers that they've read before.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I think that there are a number of people in publishing on the editorial and publisher side and the agent side who still have this sort of hope and kind of optimism about discovering new talent and helping introduce it to the world. And that's the part that's still very exciting. I think it's still possible to do that.
Mm. Well, that's good to hear. And you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with New York City literary agent Julie Bear, who in 2005 started her own agency, which is a very exciting thing. How did that come about?
It has been an incredibly exciting thing. I was at Sanford Greenberger Associates for about 6 years, which was a wonderful agency to grow up at. It was my first job in publishing, and I really lucked out because there were a number of wonderful mentors there, and I got to see a really wide variety of different kinds of styles of agenting and different kinds of projects. But I was never really the kind of person who really wanted to work in a big company. I think that when I first got into publishing, I thought I would go into editorial because I loved to edit so much. But the idea of working for a big corporation really didn't appeal to me. And that was primarily what drew me towards agenting in the first place. So I think that sort of independent spirit has been with me all along. And right at the end of 2004, I had the opportunity to join two of my colleagues who had been at Greenberger for longer than I had, who were leaving to go out on their own. And I had the opportunity to go with them, and now we, three of us, share an office space and each have independent agencies. And it's kind of the best of both worlds, I have to say.
Hmm. So I imagine you just seem to me to be the kind of agent that gets very involved with clients' work and submitting the manuscript or the proposal.
Sometimes too involved.
How could that possibly be? It seems most agents are, well, no, I can't say most, because most that I talk to are involved. But,
yeah,
you know, some of the stories I hear of, you know, just the agent sending out the manuscript or the proposal
mm-hmm.
without really doing anything to it except making copies.
Mm-hmm.
That just seems so wrong.
There are stories like that out there. There are agents out there like that, and I cringe every time I hear that because I fear they're giving us a bad name. But there are also, I think, a lot of agents who, I mean, publishing is not the kind of business you go into because you want to make a lot of money. You go into it because you love books
yes.
and you love writers, and there are a lot of us, I think, out there. For me, the best thing about my job is working with the writers and being able to take a novel that I, you know, fall passionately in love with and then help it find its audience and help it find a good home and, you know, reach as many people as possible. But It is also, I mean, I get very involved emotionally, and sometimes it's hard to sort of let go. It's very difficult when a project that you love doesn't find a home, mm-hmm. and that happens. It's very difficult when, you know, it finds a home and it's bought by a wonderful editor at a wonderful publishing house and then nobody reviews it. Mm-hmm. Or it gets wonderful reviews, but nobody buys it.
Yeah.
There's so many opportunities for heartbreak in the business.
Mm.
You kind of have to, in some ways, develop a tough skin. And at the same time, if you didn't have that falling in love, hopeful, passionate stuff at the beginning, you would never be able to go to work every day.
Right. So will you take on projects that you love, but you can't see them getting sold because maybe they're too specialized? Or if you love something that comes in, are you just willing to work it until such a time comes where, say, it's been rejected a number of times by editors and you just know that it's not going to fly in its present form?
Well, I think it's important if I'm taking on a client and I'm taking on a project to really have faith and believe that I can sell it. I think if I take something on and I don't think I can sell it, then I'm just setting us all up, you know, for disappointment and misery. So it's important to me not just to love the book, but to really feel like I know what to do with it. Often that means I know, you know, maybe what edits it needs. It's not necessarily ready to go out the door, but I feel confident that I can help the author get it into the shape that it needs to be in.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while I do read something that I love, but I think to myself, this is just, I don't know how I could, you know, successfully place this somewhere for whatever reason, because, you know, it's too quiet and the market is really, you know, in support of a very quiet literary novels these days, or because it's too much like something else I've read. And in those cases, I have to pass because I don't want to put the author through that and I don't want to put myself through that.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Julie Bear, a literary agent in New York City. Talk about the nonfiction that you represent and mm-hmm. what you especially love to work with.
I especially love the kinds of nonfiction projects that introduce me to a world or a character or a part of culture or history that I don't know a lot about. I find it really fun to sort of learn something new. So I recently sold an interesting project about, sort of in a big picture, about the history of the Shakers in America as told through one woman's story, a woman whose children had been kidnapped by the Shakers and who fought long and hard to get them back and really changed legislation in New York at the time about custody and divorce. And that was a fascinating project to me because the Shakers, you know, I sort of, you think of them as
sure.
make lovely furniture, but what else do you know about them? And I like those stories that take one person's individual story and really tell a bigger picture. I grew up in New York, so I love stories that take place in New York and that talk about New York history. People in New York, I represented a wonderful memoir called Flying Over 96th Street, Memoirs of an East Harlem White Boy.
Oh, wow.
Which was just a great story about a young boy growing up in 1950s in East Harlem and painted such a heartfelt, honest, but also loving picture of that neighborhood. So that was great. And I'm looking for more narrative nonfiction, history, biography. You know, I like to read something that teaches me something new or that taps into something that I'm passionate about.
You mentioned locale in terms of, you know, you love to read narrative nonfiction books that take place in New York or about New York in some way. What about fiction? How important is locale?
Well, I love to travel. I'm a big traveler, and I find I'm very interested in, let's say, you know, international fiction or fiction that's set somewhere where the place, the setting is really a rich character in and of itself. So I find that very interesting. It's not something that I choose to sort of take something on or reject something on the basis of, but, you know, can often be something that distinguishes a book
mm-hmm.
in some ways. I have a client named Gina Oshner who has written a wonderful short story collection called People I Wanted to Be, and there are all these fascinating story set in Russia and Eastern Europe and Latvia. And that was really fascinating to me. When I first read those stories, these were all, you know, there were a lot of places I hadn't been, and I really felt like I was seeing them through her eyes.
You know, this might be a really weird question. Okay. I have been wondering about this because of, you know, different authors talking about this very topic, and that is there ageism in terms of fictional characters? You know, it's like, it seems like so many novels, short stories revolve around people in their 20s, 30s, maybe 40s. Older than that, it's sort of dicey, even though, you know, baby boomers, you know, there's like zillions of readers over 50.
Right.
What is it with that? And is, you know, is that something writers should really pay attention to? Like, if you have a character who could be 30 instead of 60, make him 30.
You know, I'm always wary of suggesting to a writer that they try and follow, you know, a trend or something, you know, for fiction at least, that, you know, looking to see what has worked for others. And I think you have to write the character that you're, you know, is in your head and in your heart, and I think it's hard to sort of change age. I don't know if there's ageism. I mean, I think I have a wonderful novel that is about a woman in her 50s sort of discovering love for the first time, and one of the things I loved about that novel was that I felt like it was a really original story that you don't get to read, that story. And I do think that's an incredibly big audience that publishers are just beginning to kind of start trying to tap into, the same way that I think they are beginning to see how hungry teenagers are for fiction.
Yeah.
And really tap into that. I don't know. I'm reluctant to say that I mean, this is maybe naive of me, but I think what matters the most is a really richly drawn character, not their age.
Sure. Well, I like that answer.
Good.
And I'm sure many of our listeners do. Because, yeah, then you're trying to write according to a formula, and which might work for genre novels, I guess, but not for literary fiction, certainly. It just sort of kills it.
Yeah. I don't think you can sort of saying, like, you know, and we should throw a dog in there because dogs are really popular, too.
That's so funny. I talked with an editor last year in New York and just, you know, saying, what are you looking for? He goes, well, dog books are really big right now, nonfiction. And so people are going, do I have a dog book in me?
I think I've gotten maybe 2 dozen dog queries in the last month, you know, just like a whole stream of them. Thanks to Marley and me, I think.
Oh, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Julie Bear, a New York City literary agent. And to find her, she spells her last name B-A-R-E-R, and I'm sure you can find her in source books and here and there. Well, you mentioned queries, and I did want to ask you about queries, because a query letter is sort of the point of entry, I think, with an agent. And authors, or would-be authors, writers, are always trying to figure out, how do I write a query letter that's basically a business letter and still have my voice lead through?
Right.
Could you
right.
talk about that?
I think it's an incredible challenge. I think that, you know, it is really hard. I think that writers think that we don't know how hard it is to write a query letter. I know that it's hard, and I really respect that. And I, you know, I wish, I mean, it's hard. You get so many that you really are looking for the ones that pop and that stand out. The things that stand out to me are, well, first, when a writer has really done their research and they've chosen me to query for a reason. They've looked at my list, they've looked at my website, they've maybe read a book that I've represented or heard about it, and felt that their project fit in with the kinds of projects and the kinds of things that I've said, you know, in various books and articles and on my website that I'm interested in taking on. I think it's, sometimes I get frustrated when I don't do self-help, but I get a lot of self-help, you know, queries, and I feel like, oh, you're wasting your time.
Right.
Wasting a piece of paper that you could have sent to somebody who has explicitly said, please send me self-help. So I do think research and targeting your agents so that you know, they've shown that they're doing the kind of book that you're doing. If one of the reasons you're approaching them is because you happen to read a book that you loved and then noticed in the acknowledgement section who the agent was, I think it's important to mention that. You know, I love seeing that because, you know, mm-hmm. it's my ego. You read one of my client's books and you loved it. That, you know, I'm immediately won over by that. Unless it's a lie, you know, and sometimes every once in a while I get, I read XYZ, which hasn't even come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think, oh, you're lying. Ooh. So I think, you know, research is important. I think a professional, you know, sort of no bells and whistles query is really important. You know, the ones that come in sort of on multicolored paper with things attached to them, sort of, you know, or like gift baskets, you know, the query is buried at the bottom. It makes me nervous. I feel like, what are you trying to hide? you know, I think that, it one page, you know, sort of with information about yourself, any relevant biographical information or publishing history, and some, if you can, some way to make your book sound exciting and compelling without giving away all the details.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a mistake a lot of people make. They do this sort of blow-by-blow of this happens, then this happens, and this happens. And, well, now I don't want to read the book because you just told me everything that's going to happen.
Right.
So it should sort of be like, you know, jacket copy, the flaps of a book that you're buying. It's enough of a teaser to make you want to buy the book and read it, but not so much that you feel like you've just gotten, you know, the summary of it.
Yeah. Huh. What about, well, I guess this is sort of taking a left turn, but relying on your agent to guide your career. Now, how much should a writer expect an agent to advise them on what to do next? Their first book has come out, their second book has come out, and now they're sort of torn between, do I really write that novel? Do I write another book, you know, in this other field that might be more easily sold? How much should an agent get involved with those kind of questions?
I think a good agent gets really involved in those questions. I think, you know, when I take a client on, I'm really looking at the big picture, the long-term picture, and hoping that, you know, we're going to be working together through many books and that their career will continue to build. And part of my job, as I see it, is to think about, okay, well, you know, this worked. What are you thinking next? You know, are we going to go in a different direction, the same direction? I mean, it's also important to listen to yourself. What do you want to write? Because, you know, I hate to see a writer sort of write, you know, try and formulate a book based on what they think their editor and their agent want, but their heart's not in it. That book is not going to necessarily do as well. It's about what you're passionate about, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, hopefully you're with an agent you trust. You've you know, signed up with them because you trust their judgment and that they've done a good job for you so far. And so I do think it's important to listen. I mean, you know, we do have our sort of eye on the industry and the book business in a big picture way, that sometimes when you're an author and you're sort of in your little room, you know, obsessing about your book, you can't see. And, you know, we're here to help guide you.
Yeah. Oh, we're out at the end of our time. It flies. And I wonder if you have any sort of words of wisdom for the writers listening.
Words of wisdom. I think you have to keep trying. I know it's an incredibly discouraging business, and I think it's important to, you know, try and find things that, you know, give you hope and make you feel good. And I think it's important if you want to be a writer and you want to be published, then you have to go out and buy books because you have to support this industry if you want to be a part of it. And we need people out there buying fiction and buying short story collections. I know they're expensive. I know it's great to share a book and give a book to somebody, but, you know, by buying that hardcover first novel by an unknown writer, you're sort of, I believe, in the kind of pay it forward or karmic payback kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're supporting the business that you want to be a part of, and I think that's really important.
That's great advice because, you know, it's perhaps more true in certain fields like literary fiction and poetry where you really have to keep that market moving instead of, you know, just what you see in your drugstore or supermarket or which you need to buy those too, but
right,
you know.
Buy them all.
Buy them all. Spend money on books.
That's my message for the day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Taking the time. Maybe you can come on again sometime.
That would be a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barbara.
That was Julie Bearer talking to us from New York. And I had the good fortune of meeting Julie a couple years ago in New York at the ASJ conference that I blab about all the time here. And she's a wonderful woman, as you can probably tell from listening to her. Again, she's Julie Bearer in New York, literary agent. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be with Michael Tolkien, author of The Return of the Player. So please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one was built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly Signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand, online at weeklysignals.com, or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
If a Middle Earth elf lived today in Southern California, how would she celebrate and support the arts, music, and her community? What would Arwen do? Thursdays, 4 to 5 p.m., with me, Tani Tenuvio, on KUCI 88.9 FM and streaming live at KUCI.org. Ellen Salalumin Amenti Elfo.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KUCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello again. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're also streaming live on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I should say also that we are podcasting. If you go to my website, which is penonfire.com, click on the radio tower, you'll arrive at the radio page and you'll see info and links having to do with the podcast. Now we have, I wonder how many shows are up there now. At least four dozen, maybe five. And the wonderful Rob Roy, who used to be a host, a DJ here at the station, has been helping with that. And new shows are going up every week. At least two shows are going on. This show should be up next week or the week after, so keep checking that page and just all kinds of wonderful, wonderful people. Last week's show with Joe Esterhaus is up. So anyway, my next guest is Michael Tolkien. He is author of The Player, Among the Dead, and Under Radar. He wrote the screenplay for the classic Robert Altman film, The Player, and wrote and directed The Rapture and The New Age. And his new book is The Return of the Player. And I'm so happy to have you here. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
I was so interested to read this book, The Return of the Player, because I remember when The Player came out, the Player, and then the movie, both of which I loved. And I wonder if, first of all, you would talk about this book and talk about why you brought Griffin back and just its genesis.
Or maybe it's Exodus.
No.
And then we can talk about the numbers. One of Griffin Mill's spiritual uncles is Tom Ripley of Patricia Highsmith's great invention. And the first book she wrote was The Talented Mr. Ripley, and I don't know if she knew that she was going to write four more books about him, and I'm sure one day she said, you know, he's still alive. And then pursued him. And in the case of Griffin, what really started the book was that in the spring of 2002, a producer I worked with was talking about an executive. And the executive had lost his job, and the producer said, he's broke. And I knew that his definition of broke was not my understanding of the word broke. Or anybody else's, really. It was a rarefied idea. And that started to, just something about that idea started to float around, sort of like a goldfish, you know, sort of appearing one side of the mind to the other, but flashing a little bit. And then one day I was sitting in my chair in my office, and I came up with this sentence, Griffin Mill was broke. He was down to his last $6 million. And I thought of that, you know, partly, you know, I thought of the opening line of 1984, or The Clock Strikes 13, and I knew it was absurd, and I also knew that it was real, and that if I could write about someone whose decimal points are of a different order, but whose panic is the same as any order, the panic is the same as any rational person might be panicked in our society, then I could pursue something else, and very quickly as I started to write it, I discovered, as one does writing, that he was remarried, he had three children, and that the child of his second wife was older than the child of his first wife, because he'd had an affair while he was married, and I just, all these complications started to flow around. And I found that what was really interesting to me was not to write a Hollywood novel, but to write an escape from Hollywood novel.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. So a sequel that takes place...
Or a continuation.
Place...
You know, I mean, I feel like, you know, if... I don't... I mean, I suppose... It's not that there's anything wrong with the word sequel, and because it just means, you know, following. But it's cut to 18 years later,
right?
Because the book is very much follows the tone of the novel and not of the movie I wrote. The movie I wrote was I've read this book in public. It's even the Library of Congress has it listed as a satire.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, when I look at it, it's like, by an act of Congress, I've been declared a satirist. It says it on the... it says it next to the title page.
So that wasn't your genre.
Library of Congress. So, they bought the book and they put it in the satire section.
Interesting.
But there's that other piece of it, which is the... And really, the other thing which motivated the novel was a Edith Wharton's memoir, A Backward Glance, and she talks about taking W. Dean Howells to a production of an adaptation of The House of Mirth, and she had controlled the rights enough so that the play had to follow the book in which the heroine dies, and because the heroine dies in the play failed. And William Dean Howells said to her as they were leaving this theater, "Yes, what the American public always wants is a tragedy with a happy ending." And I use that as a guide to the novel, as a guide for structuring the novel. How could I write something which was both tragic and yet could deliver a happy ending that was within, that followed the rules of the characters, that wasn't beyond what the characters were capable of, but was also, at its core, a really serious book.
Yeah, interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. I am with Michael Tolkien, author of The Return of the Player. So you mentioned that first line, that first sentence,
yes,
about Griffin being broke at with, however many millions.
Just six.
kind of shabby, but whatever.
Uh-huh. Well, there are billionaires in the book.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, of course. So, but the book starts with that line, and what about the writing of the book? I mean, did you have to plot it out? Are you an outliner? Do you have to know where you're going? Do you have the ending in mind, and you fill in the rest? How do you work?
The last one.
Uh huh.
What I do is, I've written four novels. Each one has taken me 3 or 4 years to write. Each one started with a very clear situation. And the situation in this book was actually the use of charity and murder to get a child into a private school so that Griffin could approach a particularly wealthy businessman in Hollywood, a wealthy producer, entrepreneur in Hollywood, and that knot, which is really what starts the book, sort of formed at one time, and I think this is true for all of the books. I write 50 to 70 pages, maybe even a bit less than that. And then I know my last paragraph. Something happens, and I see the story laid out clearly enough so that I know where I'm going. And it's a bit like I send out my wide receiver. He's waiting over there in the end zone. And well, it's either I throw the ball and then write the novel to catch up with it, or I actually have the wide receiver out there, and then I have to keep moving the ball until I get to his arms, but I know where I'm going.
So that 50 to 75 pages is really about the book, but not the book itself.
It's the first flush of the inspiration, mm-hmm, and the excitement of the voice, because every book I've written has a different voice, and this book has, this is also the first book I've ever written with multiple points of view.
Mm-hmm.
There are, not diaries, but there are blogs, personal ads, internet chat conversations between swingers. There is that one diary,
mm-hmm,
and then there are the internal, the internal thoughts of the characters, and so there were all these different voices. And I've always written before this from one omniscient voice, over the shoulder, relentlessly and obsessively over the shoulder of a central character, mm-hmm, never leaving.
Why did you choose multiple points of view?
because I'd written three novels that didn't have them, and I really wanted to expand. I wanted to something. I think once I discovered the two wives and opened the book up from the perspective of the second wife, in line at the carpool waiting for her daughter to get out of school, watching the first wife also in line at the carpool three cars up ahead, I had all these, you know, I already had the multiple points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and looking through the windows, I mean, I think at that point I was also thinking about Flaubert's Sentimental Education, which has, I think, the first traffic jam in history in literature, where a lot of people in carriages are leaving the Bois de Boulogne on a Sunday afternoon, and you see them looking at each other through the windows, and that, I mean, it's a stock image, but I had never brought myself to that, and I just wanted to know those shifting perspectives.
Yeah, interesting. Will you read to us?
Of course.
And all you out there who just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm with Michael Tolkien, author of The Return of the Player, and he's about to read to us. Okay.
Griffin Mill was broke. He was down to his last $6 million. No one knew he was ruined. Not Lisa, his wife, not June, his first wife, not even his lawyer. But the $3 million in investments that he made in the late 1990s on the advice of his business manager, convinced of a permanent new economy, charged by an expansion of wealth made possible by technology, having reached $22 million in February of 2001, were now barely doubled. And what might have been $25 million if the studio stock had once again reached $80, and he could have exercised his option for 500,000 shares at $30, was now gone forever because the parent company had made a stupid merger, box office was down, it would never return. And the stock hadn't seen better than $17 in 5 years. He owed June and their two children, Ethan and Jessa, $300,000 a year out of his salary of $1.5 million before taxes. But since his income after taxes was barely $750,000 a year, that left him only $450,000 to spend after the alimony. He paid two mortgages. If he sold his house with Lisa, he might clear $1 million, but where would they go? The distress of his situation made him impotent, and he was allergic to Viagra.
Thank you so much. What a first paragraph.
Took a long time to write that paragraph.
I bet it did. I mean, do you work in drafts, multiple drafts, where you, you know, just kind of do your first draft and get through the book and go back and start over? Or did you keep returning to that first chapter, all important first chapter, that very important first paragraph, tweaking as you wrote the rest of the book? How'd you do that?
I like to get a running start, and I will outline. I sometimes set up a kind of a question and answer. I don't really write backstories so much, but I'll kind of plot some things out. I'm always astonished when writers say that they can't read other writers when they're writing. Because I'm a firm believer in Faulkner's advice, which is don't borrow, steal. And there are dozens, if not 100, phrases, metaphors, sentences that I've taken from books and poetry that are on my shelves and inverted, twisted, used as the foundation for something, and then taken the thesaurus and rub the word a certain way, but all of which keeps opening up, you know, keeps opening up the language to me. And in terms of rewriting, you know, what I've forced myself to do more than I used to, is print up. Well, actually, it's really important. I do this anyway. I always print up the end of the day. I don't just rely on the computer. And then I'll go back and I'll read the printed copy before I move on. I also set myself a minimum word count, usually 500 to 750 words. I'll exceed it, but I have to do the minimum. And since Graham Greene filled a pretty big shelf at 500 words a day, meticulously, apparently, like, you know, in the middle of the sentence, you know, stop in the middle of the sentence. but I understand that because, you know, that doesn't mean the sentence is going to stay the same when he gets back to it the next day. But there's a kind of open energy which he gets, and it's very productive.
Yeah.
And then over, you know, over the course of a few years, I've printed, reprinted, gone through reams and reams of paper, read, marked up with pen. You know, I'll mark up on the manuscript, and then I'll go back to the computer, and I'll take the marked up manuscript, and I'll just search for the words that I've made, those passages. And that's how I keep at it.
Hmm.
I also had a month at Yaddo to work on the book,
the
writer's colony in upstate New York.
Yeah.
And then I was doing like 1,500 words to 5,000 words a day.
I bet.
Almost none of which is left in the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was working too fast. But I got a lot of stuff out. I think it was Sontag. I read this recently. She said, she kind of likes it when she's writing badly because she's getting it out of her system.
But that, you know, that's probably... Oh, I don't know, a really good attribute for a novelist to be able to write gobs and not be married to all of it.
Well, one of the things, I have a short attention span, and I don't think I'm unique. I pick up books, literary fiction or semi-literary, popular, but, quality fiction. I see books that are 400 pages long. I see the print is small. And I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that and sometimes I think these people are deluded. These writers are deluding themselves that people are actually going to finish the book in a deep way. They might, but I my sense is our modern consciousness. If you really want to get, particularly if you're writing a social novel like I am, and you want to get into things, you've got to get in there. You've got to grab, and you've got to keep going. You have to keep moving forward. Highsmith, to return to her, wrote a wonderful book on plotting and writing the mystery novel, which is a lot of good advice.
Mm-hmm.
I want to keep moving.
Hmm.
Well, thought I had. I may come back to it. I'm sorry. I sort of interrupted myself, and I thought I had the solution to every creative question, and I just lost it. Sorry.
Well, that's okay. But you're a cinematic writer. And
that was it.
Was that it?
Yes. That what I've learned from the movie is one of the things, that you write a script, it's 120 pages long, and everybody I know who writes movies, the scripts are always, you go to the editing room, or by the time the movie is released, if you look at the script that you brought to the production on the first day of shooting, and you look at the movie as it's released, what you'll see is that along the way you may have cut 15 or even 20 pages from the script. Those 15 and 20 pages cost a few million dollars to shoot, and it's really wasteful. The rough cut of a movie, a director's first assembly, for a movie that ends up being an hour and 40 minutes, could be 2 hours and 45 minutes long, and it's absurd. So over the years, I think I've learned, I'll write a lot, I'll write long. I don't think it's important for a writer not to censor himself while he's doing the writing, and, you write, but then in the revisions and in the rewriting, you keep looking. And I was very lucky. Morgan Entrecken, my publisher, was my editor, and he was maniacal. And talking to other novelists, when they say, "Well, you edited," and I tell them that the process, serious writers with more than a few novels, they're kind of wistful because they feel like they haven't had the right editing. Editing isn't what it. Publishing a book isn't what it used to be. The editors really don't have the time anymore, again, because of attention span, to really focus on helping a writer boil it down. That blue pencil that they use is like a, blue can be a lifeline for the reader.
Mm. Well, did you begin as a screenwriter?
Graduated college in 1974, went to New York, so it was Middlebury College in Vermont.
Yeah.
And went to New York City, ran into someone I knew when I had been at Bard College before I transferred to Middlebury, and he was on his way to the track. And 3 months later, and I went with him, and 3 months later I came back from the track, and wrote an article, wrote a short story. And I thought, this is, maybe I should just do this as a personal piece and not a short story. And sent it to the Village Voice, and they published it. So I became a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was New York in the 1970s when one could live on about, $5,000, $6,000 a year.
Yeah.
And, liverwurst here, but, you know, meat and alcohol. What more does a writer need when he's 25? So, I freelanced for The Voice and saw journalism changing from the tail end of the new journalism, which was a very exciting creative period, to the rise of People Magazine and the personal journalism and celebrity journalism. So I got out, came back to L.A., then started, and I was in TV, knocked around TV for a while, didn't get things done, and then somewhere along the line had the germ of the idea for The Player. Then I wrote a script, the script that became the movie Gleaming the Cube, sold that, and instead of buying a Porsche, I bought a year and I finished my novel.
Mm.
And I also didn't tell anybody. There were four people knew about the book in the 2 years that I was working on it, which was also important. I mean, I like your questions. Your questions are really they're you know. I mean, so if writers are listening, you know, it's always I think it's really important. You know, these are good questions, but I think it's really important to let writers know sometimes that it's particularly when you're starting out. It's really good not to let other people know about it.
Mm-hmm. That's so true, because you also sort of, the energy dissipates.
The energy dissipates, and also people then ask, how's it coming? And it's a deadly question. Or you'll tell them, which is even worse. It really needs to be, at the beginning, I think you've really got to do it in private. And even, you know, when, I mean, the older I've gotten, the more experience I've gotten as a novelist, or maybe even the word confident, although confidence is not quite, I mean, confidence is really, I think, is I can finish. Not that I'm going to, you know, I'm going to win the Nobel Prize, but
yes.
I think confidence is I've been here before, I can get through this.
Yes.
I know how to get through this bad patch, even if this bad patch is 225 pages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll get through it. And the young writer, either in career, I mean, age or age of career, needs to protect his or her pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, you know, no sonograms on this one. You don't.
Oh, we could use more time here.
I would love it.
You know,
you
need to come back too. My first guest, I want to come back. We'll just do a repeat show.
Okay.
We'll just have to have you back
anytime you want.
Before we end, though. When you first came on, you were responding to something that Julie Bearer, the literary agent that was on,
right.
was talking about in terms of buying books, and you had your own take on that about book events.
Well, yeah, I think it's really important. I've been on a reading tour. I did five last week and two. I was up in San Francisco and I did two readings in San Francisco yesterday and the day before. I go to Portland and Seattle next week, and Boston. And what I've found is that, you know, it's really hard to get people out into a reading. And, you know, when you go to a bookstore, particularly if you're a writer, like, you know, I mean, writers are book buyers, or they should be. So you go to bookstores and you see the readings are coming up. And I think every writer should make it a point to go at least one reading a month at a bookstore, particularly with the first, you know, I mean, if it's a famous book that's on the bestseller list, you know, then in the New York Times, you may want to hear the writer and hear what he or she has to say. But it's the writer you don't know who really deserves being in the audience.
Yeah, so true. Because then when it's your turn and nobody's there,
then you got four people.
Thank you so much.
All right, this has been a pleasure.
This has been a delight. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
That was Michael Tolkien. He's author of The Return of the Player, and I meant it. I want him to come back, and we need to talk more. I'm going to keep this sheet of paper that I've been jotting down questions that we didn't get to. Okay, we're at the end of our time. Let me tell you that if you visit penonfire.com, you can see the schedule, who's going to be on next week. You can email me from that website and let me know if you want to be on my email list that I send out every week. I'm going to leave you with a quote from Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, "Of all that is written, I love only what a person has written with his own blood." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire, and I'll see you next time.
Mm-hmm.